The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Salam, everyone. We are back with part two of my episode with Aya. The conversation continues. As I said, the episode was really long. So if you haven't listened to episode one, I highly suggest you go back and listen to it because I think the conversation was kind of cut in the middle. But I highly suggest that you go listen to the episode prior to this if you want to continue. And if you already did, then the conversation just immediately picks up. I hope you enjoy and thank you so much for tuning in.
When the only information or the only time Yemen is talked about is in that light, it's, I feel like it's going to portray or like kind of stain the image people have of Yemen, and it'll always be like a poor, sad place. And I think that there's like negative implications of that.
Yeah, no, 100%. Yeah, and you know, also people forget the history of Yemen as well. And I think it's like, it's very important to educate people on the history of Yemen and the beauty of our culture as well. You know, when we look at the earliest skyscrapers were in Hadramaut, right? Mm-hmm. So even, you know, just things like this where people don't know, they don't know when you show them images of Yemen, of its beauty, people in their heads, I think they just think that it's a war-torn country, there's a humanitarian situation, people are getting used to also the images of starving children. And of course, it is extremely sad. It's really, really horrific what's going on. But people become really desensitized to these images when they're constantly being bombarded with them. And again, they turn them into kind of helpless victims that are unable to do anything without, you know, the white savior, I guess. So I think, you know, when going back to Yemeni creatives, like it's really amazing when you look at Instagram and you look at people's different Yemeni people's different platforms that they're using to showcase their work. And you know, you have Yemenis who, and the thing is with me as well, like it's the last time I went to Yemen is in 2013. So even for me, I didn't even realize how much Yemenis were kind of like using social media and how many Yemenis were in the creative art industries. I genuinely did, and that's my own ignorance. So do you know what I mean? Like it trickles mm-hmm. down to as a Yemeni living in diaspora, and that's something that I kind of had to like unlearn. And I was like, oh wow, okay, loads of it's not just me who likes doing art, there's so many other people out there who like it as well. So I love you know seeing like filmmakers, musicians, artists, and I, you know, I'm focusing a lot on the creative arts because I always just assumed that growing up Yemeni, it's there was always such a focus on, okay, this is, and you know, to an extent it's true, there's always just a focus on, you know, we have to, like, you know, you go down like a more academic path, or, you know, you become a doctor or engineer or lawyer or God knows what, and you don't delve into these other subjects because it's like, it's just a hobby and that's that. And mm-hmm. so that kind of came into my mentality as well. And it was only really like when I moved out, went to London, and then through the internet kind of just saw that actually, no, there are so many Yemenis using all different kinds of platforms to showcase their artwork, their creativity. And it's, if anything, it's just the fact that we need to pay more attention to that, if anything, and give Yemenis more, like more opportunities and more spaces that are catered for creatives to allow them to express themselves really.
And you're talking about specifically the Yemenis in Yemen or in general?
I mean, in general, but I think it's sometimes, I think it's kind of, I don't know if you feel this way. I don't like to speak on behalf of Yemenis in Yemen, because, you know, it's a very different experience. I also don't like to speak on behalf of Yemenis in general.
It's funny that you say that, because I think we find that most of the time Yemenis are, I don't want to say similar, but we are. Like, of course, there's like a little bit of outliers and stuff, but I feel like I could probably go into any Yemeni community anywhere in the world. And again, as long as it's not like a one-off family, but like an actual community, and I still feel like I would feel a sense of belonging in somewhere that I could adapt. Part of it is probably because I did grow up in Yemen, and like I've lived around a Yemeni community my whole life. So the exposure has been there my whole life. But we are, and I don't know, maybe other Arab cultures are the same way. I mean, I don't know. But the whole thing about like not speaking for Yemenis in Yemen, that's like been a huge thing that I've had to really think about over the past couple of years. Because when I first started, like with, let's say with my podcast, and then I was doing like a lot of work, fundraising and like raising awareness about what was happening in Yemen. And then I was like getting like bombarded by a lot of like people asking me questions, and like the local news wanting to reach out to me to talk about like what's happening there. And I started feeling very overwhelmed, because I'm like, who am I? Like someone who like lives in America, I'm like super privileged, I'm safe, I'm not having to deal with that stuff. I'm not going to say it hasn't impacted me, or like it's not impacting Yemenis in the diaspora when their families live there. But like, it just felt super uncomfortable, and it just didn't feel right that like I was the person who was going to speak out about what was happening. I can talk about my experience and I can talk about what I know, but like, we need to give that space to the actual people who are being impacted by what's happening, and not us. And when I see conversations online, wherever it is, like in a comment section of a video or on Twitter, and it's like Yemeni communities here in the US or whatever outside of Yemen talking about the issues and what they think should be done and all of this stuff, and I'm just like, that's, you want to make Yemen into something that fits you as a maghtirab, as someone who just goes there to visit, so it's nice for your little vacation with your dollars or your pounds or whatever it is. And then, so then you can just leave and go back to, you know, where you're a citizen of. And you find that like the people that are living there might want something completely different. Well, we need to listen to them. It doesn't matter about what works for us. So this whole idea of like the Yemenis there having social media over the past, I don't even know how long it's been since I feel like I felt more connected to understanding Yemeni creatives and Yemeni activists and stuff in Yemen because of social media. It's been so cool, because aside from if social media didn't exist, I don't think we would have access to a lot of those talents and those type of people. So I see like people I follow who are photographers, who are creators and like journalists and all this stuff. And it's just amazing, because I'm glad that they finally are getting the opportunity to like be at the forefront, and not us Yemeni Americans or, you know, Yemenis in the UK or wherever it is. It shouldn't be us. It should be them.
I mean, if anything, we should just, you know, and this is what I kind of always do. It's just, you know, you're supposed to, as I guess more visible Yemenis in the West, you give the platform to the Yemenis, and you literally just pass it along, because how can I speak on behalf of them? It's just, I haven't had the same experiences. It's like you said, we've grown up in a very privileged sort of way, and we still have, there's still a lot of unlearning that we have to do in that regards. Because I think we, growing up in the West, you said you grew up in Yemen, right?
I mean, like I grew up here, but I would visit often, and I studied like different parts of my life there. Like we'd go for a year so we could study Arabic. And so back and forth, but majority of my life here in the US.
Yeah. I was just going to ask, actually, like in your mind, like, would you ever want to kind of go back and visit Yemen or at some point?
I mean, I would love to go visit. Like I was, before the pandemic hit in 2019, my parents are in their 60s. And so they were planning on going back to Yemen. They actually visit Yemen a lot more often than like I have. So they were just there, I would say, maybe a few years before the pandemic hit. And that's because, you know, my grandparents were alive at that time. And so they would go back and forth to visit them. I wanted to go with them the last time that they were planning on going, one, to visit my grandparents, but also because I felt like I don't know, I was just worried with the way that the way that I've heard about like how long travel takes and checkpoints and all this stuff. So I don't know. I was like, I want to take the opportunity to go with them. SubhanAllah, it didn't work out, but I would love to go there. I have ideas of like things I want to do. So I've been working in agriculture for the past like 5 years, five and a half years. So really learning a lot about it and then learning about like the history of Yemen and its agriculture, especially when it comes to like coffee. And I mean, coffee is probably the main thing, but like even, I mean, learning about the bad stuff too, like qat, is something I would love to just go and learn more about like the practices there and see how there could be better and safer practices there for, and sustainable practices there for the way that they farm and harvest and, you know, kind of source their crops. But I mean, that's like a dream in the future. I don't know if I could ever live there, because I think that would be, I don't think that's ideal, but I would love to like visit and frequently.
How old would you have been? You've been quite young, right?
I was 15.
Okay. Just in terms of, because I mean, I've always felt like in terms of living in Yemen, I mean, we'd always go for like 6 weeks holidays. Mm-hmm. And it was really nice, you know, you're able to kind of, you'll visit family and really connect with them. And I think obviously not being able to go back for a while, you find that just that connection, you know, it's, you know, I mean, it's difficult because you're not able to kind of go and actually see them in person. So I don't know about you, but a lot of my family, a lot of them have left Yemen, so they kind of, you know, either went to Turkey or Malaysia, and yeah, so even when I kind of think back to Yemen, it's like you said earlier on, it would be very different to how you remembered it when you were younger, and even families that kind of left, I mean, even if, let's say, things did get better, people went back, it's kind of like, well, they've moved away now, and they've made a new life for themselves outside of the country. So it's almost like, is there a reason for them to go back? And I think especially when you think, well, actually, if you can find yourself, regardless of war, if you can find and get yourself a better opportunity or a better quality of life for you and your children, then you would choose that. You wouldn't, you wouldn't choose the latter. But then I guess it's one of those things where, like, I don't know, with me, sometimes there is a kind of guilt of wanting to try to make like the country into a better place, or kind of trying to help in any way. And even sometimes the guilt that I have sometimes of just in my family, like being lucky enough to be born in Britain and having that privilege of being educated in the UK. And yeah, I don't know if that sounds.
No, I think that's actually probably very common, especially if, well, one, like we're women and we're educated and I would say probably fairly independent. And that's not very common within the Yemeni community.
Yeah.
Which I want to say that's a stereotype and it does exist, I don't know, probably often. But there's a lot of educated women in Yemen. There's a lot of women in, very important positions, whether it's like in the crisis that was happening, you know, with like the cholera outbreak, like everything I saw and like everything I'd watch, it was always like women at the forefront. Women are the ones that are, you know, trying to alleviate those problems. And so women are like, there's a progression. But when you look at, sometimes I think about me and just a cousin who, the only difference is that like, I was, you know, my dad's daughter and she was her dad's, but they're brothers. But like how different our lives would be had it been the other way around, or had my dad not made the trip here when he was, you know, young and brought us all here, how different my life would be. So that guilt, I think, exists. And I think that I do think about the ways that all of us, like anyone who has the opportunity, who has been educated, has learned some type of skills, whether it's, you know, like engineering or anything in the medical field or any hard sciences that they could somehow maybe give back in some way or another, like to help rebuild Yemen, but not in the way that they want to see it rebuilt, so that it is built to benefit those who live there, not built to benefit us. And I think that's the only difference. Like if you're there just to kind of your own motives and whatever reason, like business or whatever, then like, I think, you know, they're better off without you. But I think there's inshallah going to be a chance for all of us some way or another, small or big, to be able to give back, to say that, you know, we were lucky to get out before there was war and before all of that stuff. And we were blessed with a lot. And can we give back? Because who's going to care about Yemen more than the people who like, see, like for me, when I look at pictures and stuff, like I see my own nieces and nephews in those faces. I see, like, it's so weird how, like, I feel like Yemenis have a distinct look. I mean, we don't all look alike, but there's just something about, like, when I see things, it's like I connect with those people. Do you know what I mean? I don't know if that sounds silly.
No, 100%. You know what, as well? It's Yemenis generally are just very, very welcoming people. So, yeah. Have you found that any time you've kind of you've come across any other Yemeni, or you don't know them or anything, but it's like an immediate warmth, mm-hmm. you've your heart, because they've made you feel welcomed, and it's something that it's a very beautiful thing. And you're so right about the Yemeni distinctiveness. Like I can spot a Yemeni a mile away and be like, I know where they're from. I know what city they're from. But yeah,
I mean, even with the mask on, I've had people call me out and say, like, you're Yemeni. And I'm like, how would you know? And it's just, I don't know if it's just the eyes or what, but people can, and I'm talking about non-Yemenis who spot it. And they're like, you guys have a distinctive look. And I'm like, really? Because to me, Yemenis can look very different. But I guess for the most part, we do have something about us.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's something, inshallah, in the future when things get better, that we can all find our way to visit. And I don't know, I still have family there, but like a lot of people did not leave, but all my cousins that I grew up with are like all married now and live in different cities or have moved to like either Emirates or the US. So even if I went back, I will never go back to the same Yemen I knew when I would visit. And it's a very selfish thing for me to feel sad about, because everyone left for better opportunities. But then I'm just like, well, I would like that old feeling of going back and, you know, all my cousins and all that stuff. But the reality of it is like that just doesn't exist anymore, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, I literally, it's this idea of wanting to recreate those memories and, oh, you know, we'll go back and we had so much fun, you know. Yeah. Just like stay up until God knows what time playing cards and have sleepovers, and you're trying to recreate a lot of these childhood memories, basically. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, you're right. It's a very funny way of thinking about it, but I guess it's part of life as well, isn't it? So you made a point about not wanting to stereotype Yemeni women, and I thought it was quite important. I don't know about you, but I always find I find it hard talking about issues that we face as Yemeni women, and being like as Muslim women, to be honest, and being able to speak about it in a safe space amongst people who won't judge or, you know, won't hold on to those stereotypes. So it's kind of like you're struggling between wanting to talk about those issues and wanting to deal with them, but then at the same time, you into this narrative of the victimized Muslim woman who's being oppressed. And sometimes it's so hard to find that balance, because I will defend, you find that you have to, you know, defend Muslim men, for example, when it's in the wider context, you know, being like, no, Muslim men aren't bad, blah, blah, blah. But then there are so many issues that we do have in our communities that we want to deal with. But it's like, we just need those safe spaces to be able to talk about it without worrying about whether or not we're feeding into that racist narrative, and that Islamophobic narrative, to be honest. And it's always, it's finding that middle ground, and being able to do that. But yeah, no, in terms of, you know, women and like Yemeni women, Muslim women, I think, you know, when we look at people using their creative platforms to actually, I mean, Muslim women are using their own creative platform, using their own platforms to give themselves a voice and to be able to speak about these, any particular issue that they want.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I don't know if anyone has mastered how to be critical of their community or a piece of their identity without feeding into stereotypes. Because, for example, as a non-American, I can start listening to you talk about the flaws that the US has. All valid points, all stuff I know, but it just doesn't feel good when you have other people point out the flaws of, you know, like it's the same thing with Yemeni, you know, Yemeni, and then like when someone points out stuff about Yemeni and it's like, I get a little protective and I'm like, hey, you know, you can't say that. I can say that, but you can't say that, you know? So it's understanding that, like, I think some people have the, what's the word I'm looking for? Like they have the credibility to like speak up on something and some people don't. And so unless you're Yemeni, it's like very hard for me to listen to what your opinion is or how you think things are, because you don't understand the nuances and like just all the things that like we understand when we say that, yes, like we understand like a woman's experience as a Muslim Yemeni or as a Yemeni. But like, I don't want someone who's not Yemeni to speak on it, because I feel like you're just looking at it from one piece and we're looking at it from a holistic thing. But then I look at things when women do post stuff on social media and then the comments section is like so bad. And I'm like, this is why people think this way, because of this. Like we try to fix things and protect and you know, like not allow those stereotypes to exist and live. But then it's like, ليفضحونا, you know, in the comment section.
Yeah. And then you're like, oh, I give up. Yeah, believe what you want.
Exactly. I'm like, you know, I'm done.
Yeah. Yeah, honestly. And it can be really frustrating. And genuinely for me, sometimes I have to kind of take myself out of it, especially with social media. You see the most, the craziest of debates and debates on issues that we should not even be debating about. Like, I'm sorry, why are we debating this thing that, you know, people 20 years ago were talking about? This isn't even worth our time anymore. Mm-hmm. I think for myself, I've tried to just kind of look away and I'd rather just put my head in the sand sort of mm-hmm. thing. But obviously, like, you know, when you're a visibly Muslim woman, you can't exactly do that. You literally have a sign on your head everywhere you walk. So it's not just walk away from. But yeah, so I think it is difficult kind of reaching that balance. But yeah, I mean, even when you think about non-Yemenis start talking about Yemeni women issues or whatever, and then you do feel quite protective, but also they just don't seem to understand, like you said, the nuances. They don't understand the context. So for example, when we talk about niqab, and you know, in Yemen a lot of the Yemeni women do wear niqab, and as much as, you know, when I'd go and visit and I'd feel like, you know, sometimes you'd feel uncomfortable if I wouldn't have my face covered and I would start to feel uncomfortable, but then I'd get like really angry, be like, but no, I should have my face uncovered if I want to. So like, obviously, you know, I can have those opinions, but I know for a lot of Yemeni women, there's no issue with them wearing niqab, and it's ultimately down to free choice. And actually, as well, you know, a lot of my cousins would say, yeah, I mean, when they're wearing niqab, they're like, they can basically do whatever the hell they want because no one knows them. And so in a sense, when you're, I mean, like for my cousin, when she'd have her face covered, she would feel kind of the sense of freedom, able to go to Shahr al-Jamal, which is the shopping area in Sana'a, and basically just start shouting at random men and no one being able to do anything about it, because it was like, it was a form of protection, basically. Sometimes, you know, when people come in with very Western ideas of a kind of very white feminism, let's say, and not understanding the nuances, and they go in and say, oh no, like, your freedom, you're only able to get your freedom if you're not wearing the niqab. And they don't understand actually the power that something like the niqab can give to Yemeni women in certain contexts. So it's honestly, it's a very, very complex issue. So yeah, that's why I just feel like we do need more safe spaces to be able to speak about that kind of thing. And it's the same thing when it comes to wearing hijab in Western countries as well. So like being like an American Muslim or a British Muslim, and feeling the need to constantly be like, yeah, I'm not oppressed, I'm very happily wearing hijab and it's out of my own free will. I've stopped feeling the need to having to explain myself. Like I remember when I was younger, I'd always have to explain, okay, this is why I do this, this is why I wear hijab, this is why I'm, you know, being a Muslim. And, you know, now, or like, you know, you'd start talk about, oh, you know, we don't believe in terrorism, God knows what, but it comes to a point where you're like, this isn't my job to constantly answer all these questions. I'm not a representative here. I'm just a human being.
And I feel like you find yourself doing that with both sides of your, like, I always felt like I was explaining myself to, you know, the Western American community or people that like I was around when it came to the way that I dressed and the things that I practiced and like the life choices I made being just more conservative. And then the same thing when I would want to do things, and my Yemeni community is like, Inti Bint, you can't do these things and it's not appropriate for you and whatever. So it's like you never really win, because you think, yeah, and you're in the middle, you're trying to find a middle ground between two, but like both sides eventually are going to look at you from like an extreme perspective, because you're going against the norms, you're not wanting to fit into one or the other. So it was a very like hard thing to go through growing up. To end the podcast, I kind of want to start doing this new thing where I want to ask my guests 1, 2, 3, 4, about 4, maybe 5 like quick questions. And the first one is what is the best advice you've been given?
Best advice. Okay, so I think, I guess the best advice that's been given to me is, okay, this is going to sound really harsh, but no one's focused on you. You know, when you're in a situation and you feel really, it can be big or small, like maybe you're going to the gym and then you feel really awkward because you feel like everyone's going to look at you and you're doing something wrong, or I don't know, you're out and about, whatever kind of the situation is. And then you become very self-conscious. And then, yeah, someone was just like, actually, I've heard this quite a few times. No one's focused on you. No one's looking at you. Don't worry. Just continue doing your thing and stop worrying about how something looks or how something might be perceived. It's very simple, but whenever I'm in any awkward situation, I just think of that and I'm like, no one cares about you. It's fine.
It's very true. It's actually advice I've given to my nieces, because they tend to be a little insecure about certain things. And I'm like, no one really cares the way that you think, and not in a harsh way. Like no one cares about you, but you are putting far more attention on this thing than anyone will. They're like in their own world. Okay, next question. What is your favorite quote or saying or something that you live by?
So I guess one of my favorite quotes, one that comes to mind anyway, is the fact that deen is supposed to be easy and not hard. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really always stuck by me. Just because, you know, growing up, unfortunately, sometimes we do tend to, especially as young Muslim women, we do tend to attach a lot of guilt to religion, like, oh, you know, if you're not doing something properly, or you know, is this haram, and you know is there going to be a punishment for this? And that's unfortunately, like, I think a lot of Muslims tend to grow up with that fear element instilled into them, or that guilt element or shame, rather than, and that, you know, that's not religion, that's more cultural, right? Mm-hmm. Rather than, you know, loving Allah and like actually being able to have a relationship, have a connection to your deen. So yeah, the focus of that is kind of lost, and I, you know, I guess in a way it's just a way to discipline children as well, but you know, it has its impacts. So yeah, so I'd say, you know, the idea that actually, as long as you're doing your best, and you know, Allah always tries to make certain situations or in your life easier for you, and you know, you can literally just examples from Islam, you know, like fasting, for example. If you feel just a little bit ill, you don't need to fast. If you're traveling, you mm-hmm. don't need to fast. Just things like that, where it really helps, like in a weird way, not in a weird way, in quite a sweet way. It makes you feel like, okay, Allah has my back, it's fine if I'm not able to do this. You know deen isn't supposed to make me feel anxious or stressed or anything like that. It's supposed to actually help ease a burden. And yeah, so that's something that I like to live by.
I love that. I feel like it's I always think that like there's like two ways that most people are taught about deen, and one is through fear and control, and one is through like rahmah or mercy and compassion. And like,
yeah,
those who are taught with the former are usually the ones who don't last very long or understand it or have a lot of trouble with it. And those that, you know, are brought up with the latter are the ones who tend to stick to it and just are always like more hopeful. And like you said, especially as Muslim women who are constantly being, you know, judged by, you know, how religious we are based off of like our actions or how we dress. It's like, alhamdulillah, like it's a very soothing quote, I guess you could say.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Okay, next question. Favorite book or movie, if you're not a reader like me, but favorite book.
Favorite book. Okay, I'm going to be really basic and say Harry Potter.
I knew you were going to say that. Tell me you're British without telling me you're British. I'm just kidding.
I know, right?
Actually, it's very popular here in the US. I'm everywhere, so...
Oh yeah, but the obsession still stays, right? I really wanted to like sound really smart and come up with a better book, but if I'm completely honest, the one that's really dear to my heart is obviously the Harry Potter series. And yeah, it's just like, you know, it's the series that really got me into reading. The thing is, unfortunately, I don't really read much anymore. Just, I don't know, I feel like the older you get, the I'm just thinking of excuses, but I should really read. But yeah, do you ever find like after a long day at work or whatever, you just kind of, you want to unwind with trash TV?
Yes.
Yeah, yes. Right. Like
I feel like I'm seen right now because I love reality TV or just like really obnoxious TV. Yes.
Yes. It's just like the perfect thing, you know, you just need to relax. You don't want to think too much.
Yes.
It's the perfect thing to like tune into. So yeah, so, you know, I want to say that after a tiring day, I want to like snuggle in bed with a good book, but that's not reality. That's not what happens.
I think I just became good friends because that is me. And I always felt like a little, you know, like, oh, you know, everyone talks about reading and I love to read, but I don't like really actually read books. My favorite book by the way is Pride and Prejudice. Like I love Jane Austen books, but I love just like, it's a guilty pleasure and that's how I choose to unwind. Like sue me.
No, I know, right? Hell, we should be proud of this.
Exactly.
No shame needed, right?
Yeah, we'll start a support group for anyone interested. You can join our support group for the non-readers. Two more things. What is your favorite self-care item or practice that you do just to, you know, like you said, long day, maybe it's you just answered it, maybe it's reality TV or trash TV, but like what's your favorite self-care item? It could be something that like you use or a practice.
Okay, I'm just trying to think of what constitutes a self-care. I don't know how this is gonna sit with the American audience, but I really like walking. So during lockdown, that was, I mean, I know everyone was walking, but like I was really walking. I'd go on like 4-hour walks just to they'd always have to be a destination. But no, looking back, I was like, wow, I was clearly going through it, going on 4-hour walks. But like, so I would, there's always has to be like some kind of destination. I wouldn't just like walk aimlessly. Mm-hmm. And my destination would tend to be this donut shop called Bread Ahead. So I would literally walk all the way there. And it was a really pretty walk as well. It was like, through really nice foresty areas and through Hampstead in London. And yeah, and then I'd get to Bread Ahead and I'd collect donuts and then I'd go all the way back. And it was really nice. Like I'd spend the time, I'd call up my friends, I'd call up family. I'd listen to a podcast, I'd listen to music. And it was, that was like, I really, really enjoyed those walks. But now I feel like making that same route now, I'd feel a little bit weird about it. Like it would remind me too much of like, because it would remind me too much of lockdown days.
The beginning.
I don't know if that counts as self-care.
Of course it does. I think self-care is whatever you do that helps, you know, you manage whatever is going on in your mind, manage stress. It's just a moment that you do for yourself and it only benefits you. And it seems like it was very balanced. You go, you walk, you get donuts and you're walking it off. So sounds like self-care to me.
I'm intrigued now. What's your self-care?
Honestly, I like hiking. So I do love to walk. I love to get my body moving. I really love being in high elevation. I love mountains and I love, I don't know, incline. Like, I know that sounds weird, but I really love like hiking and trash TV. So like, I love just sitting at the end of the night watching trash TV, and I really do love taking baths. So like, those are the three things that, depending on what I need to do, that like just by myself, that's how I kind of, I think, self-care practice. Yeah.
I mean, that sounds amazing. Hiking and trash TV, that's a great combo.
Yeah, I've never combined them before and I wouldn't recommend it, but you know, maybe after the hike or something.
Maybe.
Okay, last question is, and maybe you might need a second for this one too, because I know it took me a while when I kind of thought about it, but what is something you would say to your younger self if you could? Like young Aya, I don't know what age that is, that's up to you to determine, but like if she was standing right in front of you, what would you say to her? It feels like a therapy session. Sorry.
I know, it does.
You don't have to get deep, obviously, but like, what would you say to your younger self? Because we have, I know my audience ranges from like really young, like 14, to like my age or older. So I don't know. I think it's always important to think of our younger selves, because that person exists still within us. And so I think it's, I don't know. In my own like actual therapy, I've like had to think about my younger self and it's been very helpful, but I just wanted to ask people, like, what would you say to your younger self? And you could obviously choose not to answer any of these questions, by the way. I should have told you that.
No, it's not even that. It's I'm really trying to think what I would say to my younger self that isn't too deep.
Yeah.
<I'm> repeating.
I know.
I'm not joking.
No, this is not, this isn't the place you'd want to reveal anything, you know, too deep. So
I just start crying on this podcast. I would say maybe don't be scared to say no to things. And just kind of, not in a selfish way, but putting yourself first in certain situations. So it's all well and good like being really nice and being really helpful and trying to be that way to a lot of people, but at the same time you kind of need to put your needs first and just and you know, that's, it takes a lot of courage to be able to do that. Just saying no if you're not comfortable with something, or you know, it doesn't even have to be anything big. Like maybe you don't want to go on some social outing with your friends and you just want to stay at home, you know, just it's fine, just say no. And there might be a lot of FOMO or whatever, I think you know, don't be so worried about like potentially hurting other people or anything like that. Kind of putting yourself first.
Yeah, I think you'd be surprised that like that's, I think, a common thing that I hear a lot of people saying is it's okay to say no and it's okay to not feel guilty about it, because I think saying no sometimes is not the hardest part, it's the not feeling guilty part. And it's so funny because I swear, like, if what I had in mind for myself, for my younger self, is that it's okay to set boundaries and not feel guilty about it. So it's okay to say that you don't want to do something specific, or you, you know, basically aren't, make yourself completely available to anyone and everyone. And that it's okay to not feel guilty, because I think that was obviously like a problem I had growing up, and just completely like never allowing to put, never let, putting myself first. And I always felt like it was such a selfish thing to do, and I always felt guilty if I did or needed to. And so I've had to unlearn that, and then understand that when I did put boundaries, that then there was guilt, and then I had to work through that, because then I felt like, am I a bad person? Like, am I being selfish? And so it's this whole thing. But I love what you said, because I think that's a similar thing that I would have said to my younger self as well.
Yeah. For sure, that that guilt element that's kind of added to it, you know, you think you've gotten through the first hurdle by saying no, and then for God knows how long you're overthinking it, and it, you know, it, it stems from the overthinking, kind of going through it over and over in your head and being like, oh, was that the right thing to do? Maybe I could have just done it anyway, like it's not too much of a big deal. But yeah, and like alhamdulillah, that sort of thing does come the more the older you get and the more just comfortable you become in yourself, because I think a lot of it does come down to like self-esteem and being self-conscious about certain things, and you know, wanting to be liked as well. Like when you're younger, you do you know, you want people to like you, you want you know, like people pleasing and that sort of thing. So yeah, the older you get, the more you're more confident in yourself. So it does, I mean, don't get me wrong, when it comes to saying no these days, like it's still somewhat of a struggle. I mean, more so with the guilt thing, but it's definitely like a lot easier than when I was younger, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I relate so much to what you say. So that was my last question. I just wanted to say thank you so much for doing this and spending this time with me. Honestly, it's been such a pleasure, and I think even if we weren't recording a podcast, like just our conversation and like spending some time with you is like honestly really enjoyable.
No, honestly, thank you so much for having me on here. Like, I'm very honored. But also, I was thinking the same thing. I was like, we just need to like listen, next time I'm in America or you're ever in the UK, then we should totally like meet up or something. But yeah, I'm so glad like we were actually finally able to meet like virtually at least.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Until we can meet in person.